Welcome to the Steve Stein Guitar Podcast, brought to you by GuitarZoom.com. If you want to improve your guitar playing, keep listening. If you want to improve even faster, go to GuitarZoom.com, where you'll find all of Steve's premium courses, masterclasses, and memberships that'll help you quickly and easily improve your playing. Now, here's your host, Steve Stein.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Steve Stein Guitar Podcast. I have with me today an incredibly important human being, great guy, great friend, incredibly talented human being. You might know who he is. His name is Lance King. How you doing, Lance?
I'm great. Wow. What an intro.
Oh, I know. I don't know if you'd remember this, but do you remember coming to Fargo back in the 90s? I think you were with Gemini at the time, and you probably played at Cactus Jacks.
Yep.
Yeah. I used to go out and see you in that band.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That was a cool club. You just go out right behind the drums into the band house, band room. And we only played there, I think, the one time.
Really?
Maybe twice.
Yeah, I thought you had played there a couple of times.
Yeah, I guess it might have been more than that. It doesn't seem like it was a frequent venue, but on our way up, we'd go to Fargo and Grand Forks and then Winnipeg quite a bit. They had some venues up there that would be there for like 2 weeks, like a week in one and a week in another. And they were really cool Canadian venues, because the neat thing about the Canadian venues is that by law, they have to have a motel attached if you're selling booze so people can sleep. They'd make these entertainment complexes that would have, they'd have a restaurant, they'd have off-sale liquor, they'd have live entertainment, they'd have the pool and the sauna and the hot tubs and the hotel and off-track bedding and
strippers on occasion,
strip clubs. Crazy. It was just this huge entertainment complex. Anyway, it was kind of a musician's vacation in a way. Go out, play, and just hang out. Didn't have to go anywhere else. Everything was right there. If you were an alcoholic, it could be a problem.
Which oftentimes it was, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So how are things going now with COVID and everything? How have things changed with your career? And we'll get into all, Lance has just a massive list of things that he's done.
How have things changed with my career? Well, I've been working from home for a really long time. So it didn't really alter that much, honestly, other than not being able to play out live, which at the time impacted me quite a bit, because I just joined a cover band that I wanted to get back out and play and get my chops back up for live performing. And so wasn't able to do that. I put in a couple of months, 2 or 3 months of rehearsal with them, and then COVID hit and it was like, okay, we're benched. We'll go home and not rehearse anymore for a while until we're not. And then we had a few shows last summer and we're benched again throughout the fall and winter, and then spring started opening up and gradually shows started happening. And now we got about 17 shows under our belt, and it's starting to become tight, because you don't tighten it up in the rehearsal studio like you do when you play live. It's different. And yeah, so now it's starting to gel and it feels much more in the pocket. Everything's good. But other than that, I guess COVID affected music in a lot of different ways. I mean, it affected all entertainers everywhere, but I don't think it necessarily hurt sales of music, right? Or streaming of music. It probably boosted those things. As far as performing artists goes, they were hugely.
Yeah, it was interesting to see so many people, like, I spend a lot of time online as part of my living. And so that really sent a lot of people doing a lot more projects and things, and opening up Patreon accounts, things like that, stuff like that, to try and diversify a little bit, which is something we'll talk about a little bit later too, is just how to be a musician in 2021, the diversification of trying to figure out how to do multiple things, because just trying to live on the road is not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. It's a challenge.
So, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to take a step back, because I'm really interested. I've been friends with Lance for a long time, but I know nothing about what got you into music, your path when you were young. And so the first thing I want to do is just talk about, if you go all the way back, like, I could remember being a little kid and having a 45 of a song called Living Next Door to Alice. which you probably have never heard that song before, but it was a huge song for me. And I was probably maybe 5, 6 years old. And I remember listening to that song over, and I would just listen to that 45 over and over and over. And all the events that led up from there to me wanting to be involved in the music industry. When you think back, what was your first experience with music where you went, hey, I like this? Like, what's a song or a situation that you can remember that tapped your interest?
When I was growing up, we moved around a lot. My folks split up when I was 8. And so, I mean, I was fairly, but before that, we'd already moved from, I was born in Milwaukee, moved to Chicago, moved to Portland, Oregon before that. So, I mean, I'd already lived in 4 different houses by the time that happened. But music, I always remember loving music on the radio in the car. And then my parents would play, they liked music, so they had a nice stereo system and they would play music that they liked, obviously, right? Be exposed to that, the normal radio music and more of their tastes. Their tastes, as time went on, they listened to a lot of interesting things. I mean, I heard a lot of Moody Blues and a lot of Pink Floyd and Al Stewart, and who's another one that they listened to? Dire Straits. And it was pretty diverse. Dark Side of the Moon. And those songs were really like iconic in my consciousness, I guess. And because I heard them often. And because they split up, I ended up bouncing back and forth a bit between locations of where they were and different situations, different music. My brothers were listening to. I had younger brothers. They actually turned me on some really cool stuff. And I was listening to whatever I could. When I moved to Minnesota, it was more like on a whim. And long story short, we took a family trip. I came back and visited family here and hit it off. Decided to hang out with some cousins and go to school here for a while, live with my uncle. And I never left. Weird. So come graduation, my uncle and my cousins, they moved to Arizona and I stayed. Rented a house with a couple other musician friends. And we started jamming together. And before that, though, I mean, kind of jumped ahead. There was one radio station in town that I could receive in Winona, Minnesota. And that was basically Winona's KAGE FM, right? And I think it was 95 on the dial. It was all soft rock hits, which is what I'm doing in this cover band.
Right, right.
Cool, huge loop that's been fun for me. But the first bands I was in, we played metal. We played, well, I mean, Kiss. They wanted to play Kiss. And I was listening to things like soft rock and Top 40 and things like Steve Miller Band and Fleetwood Mac, that. And so metal was a new thing for me.
And how old were you at this point then?
Well, when we started playing, I guess the first band I joined, I was 16. Started jamming in a garage and we had a few pep fests at school and junior high fun nights or whatever. And we played those kinds of shows. And the second band, I was 17 and we played a couple of Expose the Future Pros kind of thing. There we'd written like a handful of originals and we went out and we just showcased them, I guess you'd say. That was interesting and fun. And then the first actual working band that I joined was right out of high school. I hooked up with some friends that I knew were musicians but had never played with them, and we started practicing, and pretty soon we were out doing B and C rooms and playing little pubs and bars, you know, having a great time. You know, I think we were playing the first gigs, we were playing for like $175 or $200 a gig, all in.
Right, right.
Here.
So all these bands, these early bands, these were cover bands. I mean, for the most part.
And that we play stuff like April Wine. A lot of Canadian rock. We loved Canadian rock in that first working band. So we did Trooper and Loverboy and Maple Wine. And then we'd do some things like America, like for softer tune. We did Daisy Jane, I think. And we glommed onto a radio station that in Winona that was the college station. And they were playing a
Minnesota band called BBC, which actually Brian Bart was part of. I ended up having a relationship with later. And BBC had a really cool album. We dug it. It was this dance rock thing, and we played a bunch of tunes off that that nobody ever had heard. They thought were our originals, and we just enjoyed it because it was fun music, right? And yeah, and then we started writing. When we started writing, we wrote about 10 tunes and recorded them really crappily. But we played them live, and they said, I should have recorded them live. More often, I think we had, but yeah, those cassettes have disintegrated through the years because we're talking 80s.
So you're doing the radio rock, all this kind of stuff. These guys are introducing you to harder rock stuff, things like that. Because what I know of you from Gemini on is metal. That's your thing is... And we're going to get back because I need to ask you about your singing too, which I'm going to go back to. But where did the transition, because anybody that knows Lance, you've got an incredible voice, but your lyrics are always so thought-provoking as well. And so we're going to get into recording and all that stuff too. But where did you start finding that shift to the style of music that you're well known for?
Yeah, the lyrics were just an evolution, I think, of who I am and my experiences. The music itself and the stylings were somewhat directed towards the strengths of the other musicians in the band at the same time. So in Gemini, when I joined them, and I think it was 85 or 86, band Freelance before that, that we had done. That's such a cheesy name. But they were really strong in doing a hard rock thing, but we were playing this really strange mix of commercial. Well, basically MTV. We were doing, and same with the previous band, we kind of morphed into that MTV, what was hot on MTV, because we lived and breathed and ate MTV every day as young musicians. Like, that was our influence then. So that started 81, 82, whatever. That's all we did is watched MTV during the day and practiced, you know? So we, in Freelance, we started doing a lot of docking and because it fit my voice. It was a clean voice and a heavy guitar kind of thing. And we were four piece and it kind of worked. So we started doing a lot of docking and that kind of stuff and transition. So when I joined Gemini, they were doing pretty much the same thing at the time. We were doing probably half, I would call it new wavy MTV rock. And then the other half was hard rock or commercial metal. And then Gemini had two guitar players that were pretty good. And just like, we need to morph into heavier sound, guys, because you guys are really good at that. And both Rob and I played keys, sort of. It wasn't like we were great at it. And so it was like, great guitars, let's highlight what our strengths are. Did a lot of, well, we also played Rush and we do things that were fun for us, but we'd play Rat and all kinds of commercial heavy stuff that went over really well. And we heavy up some old things like Thin Lizzy and Make It Fun. And that worked really well for us. And when we were breaking into the Twin Cities market, Southern Minnesota, worked really well just coming in and kicking the heavy stuff. But we're a lot more receptive to that. And it was kind of a glammy heavy, honestly. It was in, but that worked for both girls and guys. So we'd get big crowds, really heavier and a little bit more darker and thought-provoking. Well, we kind of lost the female fan base quite a bit, and it became a guy band out of the cock rocker phase and into the pure metal phase.
That's great. So let's talk about your voice then. So when did you start realizing that you had the ability to sing like better than the average human being?
I don't know that's true. I just do what I think it probably was that the people that I was inspired by were really great vocalists. I really like Steve Walsh from Kansas and Boston. Is it Brad Delp? Boston vocal was amazing. And Steve Perry from Journey was a huge influence. And I like Don Dawkins' voice back in the day. And it lent itself better to my vocal ability because I was more of a cleaner vocalist. So, I mean, like, while I love Steven Tyler, it just wasn't really conducive to my vocal. While I love AC/DC and Brian Johnson's voice was amazing. It wasn't really my voice, so I didn't really, I loved the music. I listened to it and it influenced me, but it wasn't really what was something that I aspired to. I learned to do it eventually, but it took a long time to get there. So yeah, I think when Jeff Tate and James LaBrie started hitting across my bow and I was going, wow, what's this stuff? I love this stuff. That sort of shaped me into the direction that I've come vocally and musically.
Right. When you were younger, did you take vocal lessons or anything, or was it pretty much just a natural thing for you?
It was totally natural. I did not take any lessons. I learned by copying. I basically just copied voices. As a kid, I was kind of a sound impressionist. I used to make all kinds of weird noises, and I'd figure out how to do that with what I had. It was more of trial by fire. When you're in a band that you're playing all the time and you want to do something, you just figure it out. Because we were doing it so often, I get a lot of practice doing it live. When you're live in front of people, you try, you're very focused. You're trying your 110% to do it well, so you get better. When we're playing, you know, 250 plus shows a year, a lot of time to be hyper focused. When they're 3-4 sets a night, because that's what we were back then, it was a, you know, and 4 or 5 nights a week, it was like, whoa. So you learn to pace yourself too, because you can't be putting on 110% output vocally all night, or you just won't have anything left at the end of the night, let alone the next week or for the rest of the week. So you kind of learn where you can relax, take your time and be in the flow, and where you have to belt it out, and you just pace yourself.
Sometimes I think younger people don't realize that there was a time when you would play, bands would play 3 or 4 or 5 nights a week. It wasn't just weekends. It was playing a lot. So one thing for me, and this is just because I can't sing. I'm a singing stylist. If somebody tells me a pitch, I can memorize the pitch. But for you, you've got this, you mentioned like Jeff Tate and stuff like that. You've got this really amazing vibrato. Again, did that come naturally, or how do you even develop something like that?
I had a natural vibrato, but it was more of a throat vibrato, which I liken to a keyboard frequency oscillator, VFO or whatever, where it modulates the frequency, the tone. But when I came across Jeff Tate's vocalizing and Dio's and Bruce Dickinson, those kinds of power metal vocalists, operatic kind of, I had to figure out how to do that. And so I learned to breathe all the time from my diaphragm. My mom was a hypnotherapist, and I said, hey, make me a tape. I need to learn how to breathe like this all the time. And she made me a simple hypnosis tape, I guess. And I listened to it as I was going to sleep. And 3 or 4 days later, I woke up and I was always breathing like that from then on. It was weird. And it's a healthy way to breathe. It's much more, you get a lot more oxygen because you're breathing down into your diaphragm instead of trying to breathe out into your chest cavity, which, you know, your ribs kind of restrain you. When you can't really breathe deeply that way. Breathe down in your gut cavity. And then I learned how to control that way from my diaphragm. And I would practice like a metronome with any song. And I would just practice the vibrato at different times. And I got better at it so I could control it. I mastered it, but it took a while. My ideas were out of the box thinking on techniques that I learned, but it worked.
Right. And so today now, X amount of years later, do you find yourself like, do you still practice elements of your singing? Obviously, you sing on a regular basis anyway, but are there any things that you practice?
Technique-wise?
Yeah.
Not really. The most of the things that I practice now, remembering to relax and remembering breath control at certain times and when to take the breath to support the note that you're going for. That's a big thing. It's just simple things like that. And I took a break from singing and performing for about 6-7 years. And when I came back to it, I realized that I was singing way too hard and trying way too hard. My voice couldn't handle it, for one, because I hadn't sung much for a while. So the endurance factor was less. And then it was, I was singing so hard, the pressure was, I was getting headaches from the pressure of singing so hard, trying to hit these notes, you know, for metal and things. So it was constantly reminding myself, I gotta relax, I gotta sing softer, I gotta pace myself, I gotta do this. And so I would talk to myself about that. And eventually joining a cover band really helped me practice it a lot more practically, right? Because I'm not very good at sitting and practicing on my own. I don't have a motivation if I'm not learning songs and having to perform them. It's like it's the pressure of having to perform that pushes me to practice, I guess, is really what it is. So I know myself enough to know that's what I have to do to get better. I kind of force myself into it. And it's like, hey, if I can make money doing it too, that's a bonus.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I make money practicing.
That's right. Well, that's the thing, is that's the fun thing about being in a cover band or something like that, is at least it gives you an opportunity to get out and play music that you like, but to play. I mean, a lot of people, it's fun to do original stuff, but it's also fun to do cover stuff.
And then you also learn a lot of different techniques and voicings and different ways of making sounds come out of you by learning other people's vocal character, their phrasing, their techniques. And that's how I learn, is by copying and doing it enough that it becomes natural for me.
Okay. What's that now?
Subconscious. You know, you do it enough times and it becomes a part of you.
Well, no, it was funny because last night I told you I was going to put together a playlist of a bunch of your stuff, and you can so hear the progression of your ability, your control, and just kind of stylistically becoming more of who you are today. And so what we're going to do, if you don't mind, we're going to roll through some songs here. Now, because they're all hard rock songs, like, you never start singing before about the 40-second marks. So
yeah.
There's always a large amount of music before you actually start singing here. So, So what I'll do here is I'm just going to fade into each one for you, because, again, I just need to bring up the volume for you so you can hear these. But we're going to start off a long time ago. We're going to go back to Gemini. We're going to listen to a little bit of Coming Home. Is that cool?
Oh, yeah. That's a pretty song. A pretty ditty.
Yeah. All right. So here we go. I'm going to
that
play.
That was really successful for us, too. It got us a lot of attention.
Is that right?
It was commercial. Yeah, we got a lot of radio play from that.
Okay. Well, let's take a listen to this a little bit. I'm going to start this up and roll up the volume so you can hear it here. It's interesting because you could hear the youth in your voice. And for me, again, the vibrato is so different than what I'm used to hearing from you now. But yeah, very, so cool. I love that tune.
That was, well, it wasn't pre-Tate years, pre-Tate influence, because I think Tate probably hit me in about 89. I think Operation Mindcrime, I was introduced to that, and it had a big, big influence on me. And so there's some songs on that album. You can hear it. You can definitely hear the influence there, but it's not everywhere.
So how does that song make you feel when you hear that? Like, what do you think about?
Well, it was a song to my girlfriend at the time. It was now my wife. It was one of those things where we had a relationship that had its ups and downs, emotional ups and downs. And you go out and play for weeks on end, sometimes a month, and you come home and fight and love and make up and all kind of stuff. So there's a lot of that. Musicians and relationships on the road, you know, things get dicey sometimes. That's what that song's about.
Cool.
I hope you're enjoying this episode so far and you're getting motivated to take your guitar playing to the next level. Please do me a favor and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. It'll help the show grow and reach more rock stars like you who want to improve their guitar playing. Also, I'd love to know what parts of the episode you liked, as well as what you learned. So please share this podcast and tag us at guitarzoom.com on your social post. And now, let's get back to the podcast.
All right, now we're going to move on. I'm going to play this one for you. And this one, again, is another one that I really like too, but here we go. I tell you, it sounds to me there's a bit more Tate in there, and I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. You know, for sure. Way more Tate there. Yeah, that was definitely Tate influenced. And you know, back in the early days when I started writing, I needed, sometimes you'd need motivation, inspiration, something of a storyline to write about. And so I'd get ideas for movies, themes. Like that song in particular was written around the movie Flatliners. And if you know that, you can hear the storyline. But if you don't know it, it sounds pretty cool.
Right. Yeah, I didn't know that. And I love that too. And I've always thought that the lyrics were really interesting. For those that don't know, that song was called Crimes to Bear. And it's also by Gemini. It's off the second album. Is that right?
Yeah, that was off Out for Blood, where we transitioned guitar-wise. We still had two guitars, but a new guitar player in the band who kind of took second seat, whereas Roger Moore was sort of first seat in the first album, right? I'd say Rob and I wrote half the songs and Roger and I wrote half the songs on the first one. The second album, Rob and I wrote everything. And so that was more Rob riffs than Roger Moore's riffs.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So do you still keep in touch with any of those guys?
Yeah. We're all Facebook buddies, right?
Yeah. Aren't we all?
But Rob and I connect more often. Roger, I haven't seen in a long time, but we played for a little bit in Avian on the first album, actually, and did a few shows with him. But that was about the last time we hung out, honestly. I haven't seen him in a long time.
I love this. We're going to move on to King's Machine. I'm going to play a little bit of this, Sailing Through the Doorway.
Ah, yeah. I wrote that one.
Did you?
But yeah, I wrote that on guitar.
I dig this tune.
Thank you.
So Alice in Chains. So let's talk a little bit about, so transition from Gemini to King's Machine. What's the deal there?
What's the deal?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really know King's Machine. I knew Gemini, but again, I'm from Fargo, North Dakota, so I knew what was there.
Gemini kind of ran its course personality wise. We all had our ego issues and we drifted apart that way. So it wasn't fun anymore. And with music, as well as I do, that without fun, you can't make good music. You can't have that synergy. So I decided to leave, and I was kind of the leader of the group, and I didn't want to fire everybody. So I just said, have at it. I'm going to go do my own thing. So I started King's Machine and hooked up with some other great local players that were into writing music, and we wrote a couple albums worth of material. And so we left in late 1993, and then had our first releases in 95, and first was like a 4-song EP cassette, and then recorded and released a full album, and I still got an entire album's worth of material that's unreleased from that.
Is that right?
Yeah, and we should probably talk about remaking some of those songs, dude. That would be fun.
Hey, that would be fun.
Yeah, I've got whole album, and Brian Hollenbeck from Hairball was involved in that, and he's like, yeah, we should release that. So he'd be down for recording those tunes again.
It'd be a blast, man, for sure.
Yeah, so that's something we got to talk about. Where was I going with this? Oh, the Alice in Chains influence on that song. Yeah, Alice in Chains, oh man, there was a time where they were, you know, the first time I heard them, I was just like, what hell is that? It's so dark. And then it started gripping me, the cool harmonies and the intervals and the way that he morphed that. It was just such cool music. I learned a lot by listening to Alice in Chains, I think, vocally and harmonically. It influenced my harmonies a lot.
Well, and this reinforces what you said earlier about being in a cover band and learning things. I mean, had you never experienced Alice in Chains and that vocal style, that songwriting style, which I agree. I mean, just amazing and so different from what we were used to coming from the 80s.
Right. Neat layers.
Yeah.
Just, and grooves and monster, you know, just super cool stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay. We're going to move on. We're going to move forward to this one, which is another song that I love and obviously get to play this with you. So here, we'll do this one.
So cool.
I should have played the first verse going into the chorus because we keep missing these choruses, but
yeah, you gotta play some of the chorus.
Yeah, ones. That's right. That's right. We'll get that on the next one here. So again, for me, Balance of Power is when, in my opinion, we get Lance. This is you to me, the way that I know you.
It was me kind of coming of age, I think, working with a really established band that was signed around the world already for their first album in England. It was kind of an exciting thing to fly over to England and record in London and start living the dream that you've had in the back of your mind, I guess, is being successful as a musician and getting paid weekly to record and to tour. That was exciting. You know, it's like, oh, I'm in a real band now. and getting paid, right? Well, most of those songs actually were pretty much written. I just wrote my melodies and I interpreted the lyrics the way they were, because Tony, the previous singer, had written the lyrics on that first album. And he continued on as a co-writer in the band, even though he wasn't the singer anymore. And then he became the bass player later on. And after Chris Dale left, and Chris was doing Bruce Dickinson's solo act band at the time. So there was a conflict there. More things around because Chris couldn't go on tour with us. So Tony's like, well, I'll play bass. Let's go. I was like, okay, you're the new bass player. Let's go. Yeah. So I felt like I stepped it up a bit for that gig because, you know, that was probably the first time that I actually demoed things and then re-recorded everything again. Before that, when I would record, it was what we came up with. I mean, we'd woodshed it in the studio and then we'd go in and we'd record it once. It'd be done. This band sent me the demos. I demoed up everything and then flew over there and then we recorded it for real. And so it was a different process, I guess.
Well, and that
got it out and then work them out a little bit further and develop them a little bit.
Right. So is that a writing process that works best for you? Like when you think about it, when you write, you're either coming from the angle of somebody has got something that they're sending you, and now you're, which I've always called beds, somebody's creating a riff or some chordal structure, and then you're going to add on top of that. Do you find that like it the best way for you to write, or do you generally start with a melodic concept, or how does it work for you?
For me, the system that seems to work the best is inspiration. So I get inspired from pieces of music that I love guitar. I love guitar, great guitar players. So when I hear killer riff, it's inspiring to me, like makes me excited. I get excited from that. So it brings a level of interest first off, right? So then that interest develops into being motivated to be creative with it. So what I like to do now is when I hear music or an idea, it might just be riff or it might be a fully developed song that might need some structural changes or edits, but essentially it's all there. Regardless of what it is, if it inspires me, I want to be part of developing. When I went out on my own, it was fun because before you'd be in a studio and a guitar player just wank on something, you go, ooh, that was cool. Do that again. Let's work on that. You know what I mean? That's super neat. But after I wasn't woodshedding anymore and I was working with people internationally and, you know, I just say, send me ideas, send me whatever you've got and let me listen because you either get inspired or I won't by what it is. And so when I ventured off onto my solo album, I thought, hey, I'm just going to invite a whole bunch of cool people that I know and see what they got lying around for ideas that they haven't used and see what we can do about developing those. And so I sent out an email to a bunch of people I knew. And within 2 weeks, I had literally two albums worth of material to read through. And I weeded through it. I just picked what I liked the best and started writing songs with it. And basically, pretty much, not always full song ideas, but a lot of them were pretty developed ideas musically. And then we'd add to it. And I'd do my thing. I'd write lyrics and melodies and harmony, sometimes other parts, if I thought we could do it, work on arrangements.
Very cool. Cool. All right, let's move on. Now we're going to move on to Pyramaze and Melancholy Beast or The Birth. Which one?
Got to go with The Beast because that's like idle track.
Yeah, it's very cool. All right, here we go.
But you got to get through the chorus.
Yes, we have to get through the chorus this time. That's great. It's good stuff, man.
Yeah, that was a fun album. Fun bunch of guys to work with. They were all, well, I was about, I think, 40 by the time, 41 by the time we started working on that stuff. And these guys were all in their early 20s. They were excited. They were they were really keyed up and motivated and all really good at what they did. So it was kind of an exciting project. A lot of energy in it. A lot of power and testosterone, I guess.
Yeah, I love that stuff. Okay, let's see. So we're going to move on. You'll know this one. This is Avian. We're going to do As the World Burns here.
Jan's lyrics are kind of prophetic, aren't they?
Yeah, no kidding. I was going to say that some of the stories in the Avian stuff is pretty amazing.
He used to send me these guys' videos, and he was way into this information that at the time I felt was all just fear-based, and we needed to focus just the positive aspects of things. And turns out he was kind of right. There's a lot of weird stuff going on.
No kidding. No kidding. Yeah. So Avian, just so people knowing, this is where my connection with Lance became more solid, because Avian was losing their guitar player at the time and they were looking for a guitar player. And I was living in Fargo. I played in a bunch of bands around the area and stuff like that. And my wife says, you should go try out for that band. And I'm like, well, I suppose I could. I was just terrified to go down to Minneapolis and suck. So I got a hold.
Yeah, right.
Well, I hadn't played in the cities before. And I mean, I'm kind of a perfectionist on a number of levels. And so I found out the set list, learned the songs, all that stuff, and drove down to the cities and practiced with you guys. And that was it. That it went really well. And
like, dude, you're in.
That's exactly what it was. I was talking to Brian, because Brian Hollenbeck, who had mentioned earlier, was in this band as well. And I was talking to Brian about a week ago about this. And he's like, yeah, it was so funny because you showed up and like you knew the songs better than anybody else knew the songs.
It helped.
I was the same as Lance said earlier. When you're in bands, it's always so much better if you can be in a band with people that you actually consider your friends, like people that you get along with and you can enjoy their company. And I've always been blessed with being in bands that were exactly that. I've had a couple of ill situations, but for the most part, it's always been. And so with this band, it was interesting because I wound up becoming very close with Lance and everybody else in that band. So I listened to those songs and I didn't have anything to do with the writing on them, but they mean a lot to me just because it was just a really exciting time for me to play with you guys in that.
It's kind of fun. Got some decent shows and got to go out and have some fun and make noise. I like making noise.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right, cool. And now we're going to move up into Lance's solo stuff. And gosh, I had a hard time. I mean, there's so much good stuff on Kairos, but it's either between Awakening or Infinity. And I love both of those songs. So I'm not sure which one we should do.
Yeah, those are both Marcus Sigfridson songs. I wrote with him and he's got a gift for sure.
Yeah. They're catchy. They're thought-provoking. Which one do you think?
Well, let's do Infinity Divine because I focused on Awakening it enough, I guess. Infinity, a lot of people seem to think that it, I mean, I'm not even going to say that because that'll distract the listener. So just let them hear it. Thank God.
Okay. Here we go.
Thank you.
I can't tell you how much I love that song. I love that song so much.
Yeah.
On so many levels, man. And then the end, when it gets all mellow and then you keep singing that same thing over and over and over and it modulates. Oh, it's just so cool.
Yeah, it's a fun part of creative process. It's like experimenting and finding things that just, I don't know, morph and feel neat. Musically, emotionally, I feel like my voice is a way to connect with people on a higher level, almost. It's a way to communicate emotions and thoughts and all kinds of things at the same time.
And I would agree with that. And then you put the lyrical content on it. There's a story. There's a real story going on so often. And we're going to get to your newest album here in a minute. But when focusing on the positives, focusing on the what ifs, the possibilities of things, where, like you said, Jan's stuff in Avian tended to be a bit more dark and your stuff tends to be a bit more light.
Yeah, the light end of the spectrum, talking about the darkness and the impending things going on, but framing it different.
Right, which really fits into your being too. I mean, that's the thing is I've always lived my life the same way. I mean, you can focus on whatever you want, but if you're always focusing on negative energy, the negativity tends to come right back at you. So,
right, yeah, it's a cyclical mirror kind of thing where a figure eight, like Infinity Mind, you throw it out there and it comes back at you, whatever you're projecting, you project, or like a boomerang. Energy, everything is energy. And this 3D reality we find ourselves in seems to be a reflection, a big reflection of whatever you put out comes back at you. So if you're constantly negative or you're having constant negative thoughts or you're being an asshole in general, it seems to come back at you. And when you put out really more positivity, and I've had that experience on both ends of the spectrum throughout my life. And I decided I much prefer the light end of the spectrum for sure. And it's strange. I feel like throughout time, as I've grown older, time has shifted and that things were happening faster and faster and faster, right? You notice when COVID hit, everything slowed way down, right? The energy and the frequency of everything slowed way down. It was like, this isn't so bad.
Right.
I settled into it. I'm like, okay. This song, Infinity Divine, was, I think, well, we wrote it at the beginning of 2011 and got it out by 11/11. And the idea was based more around, well, it was kind of twofold. I felt this urgency talking about the end of the Mayan calendar for some reason. There was this impending fear that the world was going to end with a lot of people, and I just knew it wasn't. But what was that really about? What were the Mayans talking about was more important, and I think it was misinterpreted. And my impression of it was that a new cycle was going to begin, and we were at the end of a certain cycle, and the new cycle was going to begin, and there was going to be, well, with the ending of the cycle would be some chaos and some changes. And we're witnessing that over the last 10-11 years since the album came out, and lots of changes since. And also I had this concept that they might be talking about linear time versus Kairos time, and Kairos time being nonlinear and all things kind of happening at once. And it seems like over the last 10 years, the chaos that has ensued could be directed toward that concept, in that maybe if you believe in string theory, where there's lots of different timelines happening at all different dimensions or whatever, that any possible outcome from any decision that you might make might split off and have an alternate reality. Well, if all of those things merged at a certain point in time, in a Kairos time where all of the possibilities came together, then you'd have chaos, right? Everything would be upside down and backwards and strange. Every day you're running into something new that didn't make sense to your perception of the past, which falls into a lot of, what's the terminology? I'm having a brain fart. The Mandela effect.
Oh, right? Yeah, right, right.
The Mandela effect, where you remember something differently than it is, or it is now, but you're certain that it was different in the past. So all of that kind of stuff into that lyric and those concepts and that philosophy and kind of interest in it. And the whole album in general was kind of about that and my strange phenomenon of experiencing the time prompt thing, where you see repeated numbers all the time on clocks and various locations and different things, not just clocks, but seemed more prevalent on digital clocks, obviously, started happening. And it might just be written off as, what do they call that? A repeating thing in your subconscious where you're more aware of it because you're aware of it. Like when you go and buy a new car and all of a sudden you're seeing that kind of car.
Right, right.
It might be written off to that kind of a phenomenon or not, but since I was about 14, I noticed, you know, like the 11-11 time prompt phenomenon where I would see that number a lot. Like I just happened to glance at the clock. Another plane. Can you tell I live near a runway?
Yeah, no kidding. While you're waiting for the airplane, I'm going to start some new music from your new album, okay?
All right.
Here we go. Good stuff, man.
Yeah. Positive messages for all.
Yes. Well, that's the thing, is trying to choose a song off this one is really tough too, because there's so many really, really, really good ones. But I love that one for sure. And the message of that one for sure.
I think that's one of those universal themes that everybody appreciates, I guess, is the idea that we're limitless, but we get in our own way most of the time. And the self-doubt and the programming that we've got throughout the years from parental influences, rather, and school, the knowledge that we were fed early on, and influences from actors and church and various other things that have filled our minds and our subconscious with these concepts, can be either limiting or can be unlimiting, depending on how they're framed and your mind processes them. A lot of us got bad programming and a lot of us got some decent programming, but the mirror reality, what you put out coming back, kind of concept that if you're in the flow of the river, you're flowing with the river and you're not fighting, you're trying to avoid the negativity, you're trying to avoid the sharp rocks, that you can have it's easier to get to the goals that you're after. You know what I mean? If you can avoid that, those kinds of pitfalls and things. And it's hard. I mean, geez, because you're not the only control factor, you know, everyone else is also projecting into the mirror that, you know, that can have big effects on you depending on how triggered you are, you know, self-conscious, you know, or how you react. If you're reacting versus being proactive about things so it's a challenge. It's a big learning scape for sure, spiritually.
When you record these things, do you find it purging for yourself when you write these lyrics and things like that?
It's
I would assume so.
Yeah, for sure. It's cathartic. And it helps me voice feelings and thoughts and concepts that I think need to be released, because I feel like there's just certain things that I've learned and accept as my truth. And I share them in hopes that maybe they'll help influence others in a positive way. Whether or not they connect or not is completely up to the listener and how they frame them, because it's going to be interpreted however it's interpreted based on their own experiences. But yeah, the energy in general that I'm putting into it is a good one, hopefully to be inspiring and helpful, healing.
Yeah. So anybody listening, I mean, you can jump on Spotify or whatever, and you can check out all these songs that I've been showing you, but certainly these last couple of Lance King albums are definitely worth checking out and really listen to them. Listen to them, look up the lyrics. I found the lyrics for pretty much all of these songs on the internet. So there's all kinds of stuff out there. And like I said, it's what's so awesome about it, other than the fact that I get to play this stuff with Lance, is just that the songs are thought-provoking, and I've always enjoyed that. I grew up listening to... You grew up in the 80s. Well, I mean, I grew up in the 70s, but then moving into the 80s. And there was very little that was thought-provoking in the 80s. It was all about the same thing.
Girls and dancing.
Yeah. There's not much to think about. And so I was so in tune with the guitar that the singer was irrelevant to me. It was just something to keep me in line of when the verse or the chorus was coming. And that's all lyrics meant to me. And it was in the last maybe 15 years of my life that I really started going back and finding music that it wasn't just about that. It was about the content of the lyrics of the songs. And if you're into that sort of thing, you should really check out what Lance has got going on, because like I said, musically, they're awesome, but lyrically, vocally, they're amazing. And I'm not just talking you up. I really love this stuff.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I mean, I guess the people that inspire me lyrically were the likes of Queen and Kansas and Rush, and really thought-provoking kinds of conceptual and out-of-the-box lyrics, really. They were more mature. They spoke something new to the listener, I thought. And, you know, like Dust in the Wind, what a great lyric. Oh, my gosh. 2112, that whole album was like, wow, that was this sci-fi epic. Pretty neat on all the Rush albums were really thought-provoking, because Bert's lyrics were amazing. And Freddie, you know, being who Freddie was, wrote some really interesting thoughts too, lyrically, I thought.
Yeah, that's cool. So, Lance, if people want to find you for whatever reason, whether it's to work with you, I mean, what else do you have? Like, I know you do some lessons locally, do like vocal lessons online and stuff as well, or are you pretty limited on that?
Yeah, I've been doing Skype and even Facebook group kind of lessons. Well, it's not really a group, it's one-on-one, but it's through their group messaging thing that they do face-to-face kind of thing. FaceTime, I've been doing that. I started teaching at a Rock U here in Minnesota, or in Minneapolis area. It's in Woodbury. It's a new music school. I'm teaching there as well. And doing privates in person. I prefer that. I like in person, but it's super convenient online. And so scheduling becomes a lot less of a problem, meeting people, because I don't do lessons at my house. I'm like, that's my private place. You got to have a private life. So you got to draw the line there. And I've done lessons hanging out. Grayson and I would like meet up in a Caribou parking lot. We'd hang out in the car and sing and get a cup of coffee and just hang out for an hour.
So how do people get a hold of you? If they're interested in working with you, how do they get a hold of you, Lance?
Probably the best way is through Facebook, but I don't want to rely on that. So people can email me through my website. That's LanceKingMusic.com. That's probably the best way to do it. You can message me through my official Facebook page, though I generally don't. I'm really bad about getting messages on there. Private one all the time, or my personal one, which I'm less friends and it's easier to keep up with. So I have a bot that answers the official one, and then sometimes I'll get back, but it'll be a while. So that's probably not the best place to do that. But I did just add to the official, now that I think about it, actually, this is probably your best. On the official Facebook page, it asked me to connect a WhatsApp thing to it. So people could message me through that on the official page, and I would get that to my phone directly. It would be a lot easier to get me than through the messaging Facebook thing. Yeah. And maybe, I don't know, I'm not sure how it's linked, if it's linked to the messaging or if it's linked to my phone number or what, how that's working, because I haven't checked it out yet. It just connected it yesterday. So that might be, I'm not quite sure. So we had, isn't that funny?
So for sure, LanceKingMusic.com. Yeah, I know. I know.
And yet I don't pay attention to hardly any of them. It's best to get in touch to the ones that I do pay attention to. And email always works. Yeah. Lance.King@Mac.com.
Lance.King@Mac.com.
Yeah, nice and easy.
Okay, cool. Well, my goodness, thanks for the amount of time you've given me. I'm actually going to be heading out here. I've got to go for an eye appointment, which is why I have my glasses on. But thanks for everything, and I'm sure you and I will be talking very, very soon. So,
sorry with all the outer noise. I came into the front yard because it wasn't in the sun, and on the street, and there's garbage trucks. Got some crap going on.
I know how that is. So
thanks.
Awesome. Well, thank you, buddy. And thank you to everybody out there. Thank you so much for joining us. And make sure that you look up Lance.King@Mac.com or head over to Lance King Official on Facebook and check out Lance's stuff and get a hold of him.
.com, yeah.
What's that now?
Or LanceKingMusic.com.
Or LanceKingMusic.com. That's right. Cool. All right. Well, take care, my friend, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Rock on, brother.
All right, buddy.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
If you enjoyed today's podcast and want to learn guitar even faster, go to GuitarZoom.com and click the Get Started button to get access to courses that are right for your interest and skill level. Again, go to GuitarZoom.com and click the Get Started button.